At the outset, I would like to offer my humble pranams at the lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan. Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. It's a long time since I broadcast what might be called an occasional musing talk. Indeed, for nearly 3 months now, I have not been in touch with you. I am sure many of you are aware of the reason. Firstly, I was away from the end of August for about 5 weeks, traveling across New Zealand and Australia and wrapping it up with a fleeting visit to Manila in the Philippines. I returned in early October, after which the birthday season absorbed all my attention. Immediately following that, I had to do a rapid 2-week tour of Hong Kong, Southern China and Japan. I am now back and with so much work staring at me, I just cannot afford to be absent even for a day. On the contrary, I have to work overtime. However, that does not bother me as that is my normal routine. My only concern is about meeting the many demanding schedules, particularly because we are starting many new activities besides expanding what we are already doing. Let me get down to business and begin by outlining what I propose to do in this talk. I shall start with a short comment on my two recent overseas tours, my first one after 14 years. I shall then reflect on various matters of current interest and wrap up with where we need to go, as also what we all ought to be doing. As I mentioned earlier, my first tour began in New Zealand. I had been there once before, way back in 1995. Since then, I have maintained good contacts with a few devotees there, which helped me a lot during my recent second visit. Like last time, I visited many places and also gave several talks. However, this time my tour was tailored to accommodate many talks and discussions with people outside the devotee circle. I am happy to say that this happened throughout the tour. Thus, in New Zealand, I not only addressed 2 public meetings, but also gave a talk in a university and in a hospital as well as a school, besides talking to many people connected with education and healthcare. I also had the opportunity to have an extended conversation with 2 doctors engaged in compassionate healthcare, conversation with elders of the Maori community, and also very interesting conversation with a member of the New Zealand Parliament. In Australia too, I had a few interesting engagements, the most notable of which was a talk I gave in Melbourne on UN Peace Day in a beautiful setting, which is an old church with a serene ambience. I shall try and include some pictures relating to all this in the written version of this talk, which should soon be posted on our website. My Manila stay was hectic with 6 engagements packed into 1.5 days. If I managed that at this age, it was entirely due to Swami's grace. My schedule in Manila included a talk at the Asian Development Bank and also at the Asian Institute of Management. I should not forget to mention that unlike I normally do, this time I illustrated all my talks using PowerPoint slides, and that made a big difference, particularly when I spoke about the life and mission of Swami. Word has got around, and there has been a great demand for recordings of the talks delivered in New Zealand and Australia. Yes, they did make an attempt to record those talks, but since the original recordings are of varying quality, I have decided to re-record them here, since that is simpler. Of course, this exercise would take some time to complete, since I am preoccupied with many tasks, a good many of which go beyond Radio Sai. I should mention that though there was pressure to speak about my so-called experiences, I always stuck to speaking about Swami's teachings. I explained that Bhagavan once told me emphatically, people come here to see Swami and know about His message. So, in your talks, confine yourselves to the teachings and avoid storytelling. That is what I have always endeavored to do, not only when I spoke in the Divine Presence, but also while talking to you over Radio Sai. And over the years, I have found that the message too has plenty of takers. Naturally, there are many memories associated with these tours coming quickly after each other, but there are too many to be shared here. I shall restrict myself to recalling just a few, since they are symbolic of how Swami's love silently and imperceptibly pervades everywhere. When I arrived in Australia after a 2-week stay in New Zealand, I stayed for a couple of days on the Sunshine Coast on the east with my good friend Douglas Saunders. I reached there on the night of a Wednesday, and next morning, Doug drove me out to a farmhouse up in the hills. It was a nice, leisurely 1-hour drive through the farm country. The farmhouse I was driven to belonged to one Mr. Nigel Sims, who came to Swami way back in the 80s. He's not that well off and could not afford many trips to Prashanti. However, he has remained totally dedicated to Swami in every possible way. Swami told him to have bhajan sessions on Thursday and in the morning. Thus, his bhajan sessions are at 10:30 a.m. Usually about 10 people attend those bhajan sessions, but on the day I went there, there were about 2 dozen or even more. And all except me and a Sri Lankan devotee were white Aussies. I was deeply touched by many things I saw there. For example, one lady had driven 3 hours to attend the bhajan that day because she had heard I would be there. That moved me a lot. The visitors included 2 ladies who were both deaf and dumb, but they wanted to be there that day. And there was an 88-year-old psychologist who has had amazing experiences, who made it a point to be present there at Nigel's house that morning. The bhajan hall was small and it was clearly modest, which was a huge change from all that I had seen up to that point. Nothing was fancy, but that in no way made it less serene. Right in the middle of the altar was a framed panel containing the words of the Gayatri Mantra. In a corner was a small statue of Ganesha, and I was told that one day a small mouse peeped into the bhajan hall, ran up straight to Ganesha, had a good look, and ran back out of the room. Nigel led the bhajan session, most of the bhajans being in English. However, in the middle came Manasa Bhajare, sung by Nigel himself. When the singing ended, there were meditation passages that were read out. Well, those of us who were present in the audience reflected on what was said. After the formal session was over, I was asked to say a few words. Frankly, I was totally overwhelmed. For me, it was a very special experience. I was completely stunned by the fact that someone in faraway India, someone who never went abroad except for 1 short trip to Africa, and that too to visit the house of a devotee, that someone could inspire and fill the simple people in a different hemisphere with undying love. All these people in the bhajan hall were vegetarians, though they were white, and they did not drink or smoke. Their dedication to Swami and His teachings were total, which to me was awesome. It was also a remarkable proof of the power of Swami's magnetism and love. Another experience that I cherished was what happened after my talk on UN Peace Day. That was on 20th September. As I told you, it was in Melbourne. My talk was entitled, Can Science and Spirituality Come Together to Promote World's Peace? After the talk, I had the odd experience of many people wanting their pictures taken with me. This has never happened to me before, which is perfectly understandable since I am neither a celebrity nor a movie or sports star. I was feeling quite embarrassed when two people approached me and asked me if they could have a picture with me. After saying sure, I asked them where they were from, as they were not Aussies. They both said they were from Lahore, Pakistan, which just blew me away. To me, this was very special, particularly because as a boy, I had attended school for 5 years in Karachi from 1940 to 1945. That was before the partition of British India. After partition, Karachi went to Pakistan. It was a totally unexpected and an eerie experience. It was UN Peace Day, and there I was from India in a church in Australia. And here were two Pakistani Muslims wanting a picture with me from India, a Hindu. I looked up and said silently, Swami, what a leela. I am sure you must be smiling. Only you can bind people with love in this manner. I had a similar feeling when after my talk in the Asian Development Bank, a Japanese gentleman, I was later told he was the number 3 man in the Asian Development Bank. This gentleman stayed back to chat with me for over half an hour. He had seen World War II and the atom bombs. He was happy to talk about compassion and tuning social welfare projects to be in resonance with the real-life problems the beneficiaries face. What I am trying to say is that even a hard-nosed institution like the ADB, which is like a mini World Bank for Asia, was impressed by what Swami had done for the poor without stretching out his hand or getting funds from IMF and agencies like that. One of the reasons why I am so keen about the teachings of Swami is the simple fact that if they are applied earnestly, there is no problem on earth that Swami's teachings cannot solve. This is not a glib statement. Rather, it's a very calculated observation made on the basis of deep reflection over years about the many problems affecting human society, in conjunction with a careful study of Swami's teachings. If you think about it, there are basically 2 distinct categories of challenges that the human mind faces. The first relates to what I might refer to as challenges from the outside, while the other concerns challenges set up by the mind itself. The latter is the root of most of our problems today, and they are also very difficult to handle unless, and this is important, unless we earnestly apply the teachings of Swami. Let me now amplify the above remarks. I start with smallpox, which is a typical example of a problem from the outside, that is to say, not generated by the mind. Almost everyone born after, say, 1985 would not know what smallpox is. But do a bit of Googling and you would get some stunning information. For the benefit of those who do not know what smallpox is, here is a short narrative about it. Basically, it's an infectious disease caused by a virus, and a pretty deadly one, I might add. If it fails to kill, it often blinds the eyes. At the least, it leaves horrible pockmarks all over, especially on the face. I had a classmate in school who bore such scars. Some of you might recall Mr. Kasturi describing how his father died due to that dreaded disease. It is believed that smallpox emerged around 10,000 BC, and the earliest evidence of it is available from mummies going back to 3000 BC. Smallpox attacks used to come in waves, and as a young boy, I do remember some of those waves. The vaccine, as we now know it, was developed in England towards the end of the 18th century. Since then, young children were given this vaccine soon after birth. However, since the health services were not organized well in the 19th century, and indeed even in the early part of the 20th century, smallpox raged fiercely. You may not believe this, but it is estimated that smallpox was responsible for somewhere between 300 to 500 million deaths during the 20th century. 300 to 500 million deaths in one century, all due to smallpox. One way of looking at that number would be to say it is roughly 7 to 10 times the number of people who died during Second World War. In whatever way you look at it, 500 million deaths is an awesome figure to contemplate. As recently as 1967, the World Health Organization estimated that 15 million people contracted the disease and that 2 million died. But you know what? The last naturally occurring case of smallpox was diagnosed on 26th October 1977. And by 1979, the World Health Organization declared smallpox to have been eradicated from the face of the earth. That's right, eradicated from the face of the earth. To me, this is an absolutely incredible feat, a remarkable achievement that is hardly ever mentioned these days. I use these effusive adjectives because as a boy, I have known what terror that disease struck when an epidemic broke out. In 1958, when I had to go overseas for the first time, I had to have special smallpox vaccination certificate. For obtaining this, I had to go to a United Nations certified agency in Bombay, as it was called then, and get a shot. They then issued me a yellow document that looked like a passport. It was stamped, signed and all that, and the particulars entered included the batch number of the vaccine used. This vaccine, by the way, had to come from a WHO source. And when I entered Canada after traveling 48 hours, those were before the days of jet travel, the first thing they checked was the health certificate. Passport came only after that. In fact, it was the same when I came to the US in 1968 to spend a year at the University of Ann Arbor in Michigan. First the health certificate and only then the trip to the immigration counter. Today, all that has become a dim memory because of the incredible progress made on disease control. Now, why am I going into all this? For a very good reason. You see, the human mind is extraordinarily powerful and has an amazing capacity to rise up to all sorts of challenges, provided those challenges are not created by the mind itself. This is a very important point that somehow most people, including the very intelligent ones, totally miss. Indeed, there lie most of our problems, which is what I now wish to focus on. Consider some of the recent scientific triumphs. Some months ago, there was a great buzz about the discovery of the so-called God particle in the International Scientific Laboratory, known as CERN, in Geneva. I cannot go into the details of that discovery nor describe here why that discovery was a landmark event. Nevertheless, I would like to say that it was a tremendous feat and a remarkable triumph of the human mind. Next, I would like to call attention to the landing some months ago of a small laboratory named Curiosity on the surface of Mars. Normally, such events are remote controlled. That is to say, buttons are pressed in a lab on Earth, which then transmit signals to the spacecraft to guide it. Pilotless planes and near-Earth satellites are also operated by remote control. In the case of Curiosity, this was not possible. Why? For a simple reason. You see, Mars is quite far away, and on the average it would take about 12 minutes for an electronic signal to travel from Earth to Mars. And that too at the speed of light, mind you. 12 minutes is a long time where electronic control is concerned. And for comparison, I might mention that it takes about 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach the Earth. So that is how far Mars is from the Earth. Please keep that in mind. Now, I am sure most of you are aware of the now retired space shuttle. When it was in service, it was used repeatedly to travel to the International Space Station, carrying both cargo and astronauts. On the return journey, the speed of the space shuttle would be around several tens of thousands of kilometers per second during the re-entry into Earth's atmosphere. Now, from that hypersonic speed, the spacecraft had to be rapidly decelerated before actually landing and coming to a dead stop on the tarmac of the landing ground. And that required a lot of dynamic rapid-fire control action by the commander of the spacecraft. Curiosity had no pilot. If it had to be landed by remote control from Earth, then one has to remember that it would take about 12 minutes for the control signal to travel from Earth to Curiosity. After that, it would take another 12 minutes to bring back information about the control action. Obviously, this kind of control would simply not work because things happen very rapidly during a landing. Curiosity was therefore designed for auto-landing. That is to say, instruments on board had to judge conditions instant to instant and safely put the laboratory on the surface of Mars. Now, this is an exceedingly complex task, and there was no way of fully checking out the control system on Earth before the launch. After all, Mars is different from the Earth, and we have so little knowledge about it. And when Curiosity made its first contact with the surface of Mars, the first signal about the fate of the landing would be known on Earth only 12 long minutes after the event actually happened on Mars. Thus, at the time of touchdown, first touchdown of Curiosity on the surface of Mars, there were 12 long agonizing and nail-biting minutes before the people in the control room in California became aware whether the mission was a success or a disaster. As we now know, not only did Curiosity make a successful landing, but it has since been working remarkably well, beating all expectations. By any account, this is a stupendous achievement for humankind. Once it was known that Curiosity had landed safely, everyone in the mission control room broke into huge smiles and cheering. There was widespread celebration, singing, dancing, people hugging each other, congratulating each other and all that. But you know what? In the midst of all this, I did not hear a single person, not in the lab, not in the media, not in the wide world, which reacted with great amazement, not one single person ever mentioned how all this was possible because the Almighty has blessed humans with a very powerful mind. That is how accustomed we all have become to using the power of the mind without being conscious that this power has been specially given to us by God. In fact, this indifference to how much God pervades our daily life is far more widespread than what I described. And maybe I shall come back to it later. Swami once said, God created this beautiful earth, complete with a lot of land, plenty of good water, and of course a huge blanket of clean air surrounding the entire planet for all living creatures to breathe. He then told man, "Son, all this is for you to use and enjoy. It's completely free. Just make sure that you use all these resources in a responsible manner and leave them as I gave you so that future generations also can enjoy them the same way you have been able to." Swami continued, "Has man done that? Hardly. Instead, he has grossly misused the blessings I have conferred. Besides selling what I have given free, you must not only sell land and all that it contains like coal and oil, for example, but have also heavily polluted land, water and air. In other words, man is taking everything so much for granted that he no longer bothers to express gratitude for the bounties I've conferred. Absolutely free, I might add. Man's indifference to God goes far beyond mere ingratitude and misuse of air, land and water. The power of the mind is now being increasingly used for the most abominable perversion. This is a painful topic and I personally presently do not want to go into it in detail, but I am compelled to refer to some of the events that have made headlines in recent times. Depending on the circumstances and media's preferences, some events get a lot of visibility while others remain unknown. Even events that are on the front pages and the TV screens for a while soon get edged out because there are new crises, scandals, disasters and sensations to report on. Most of us are swept by the 24-hour news cycles and sway with it, egged of course by the social media. From a larger perspective, however, we are mostly passive spectators and take little initiative in eliminating the root cause of mind-made problems. Notice, I am not saying man-made or human-made, but mind-made. There's a deep reason for this, which I shall touch upon shortly, especially because as it relates to a key teaching of Swami. When atrocities occur, all of us express anger, sorrow or helplessness as the case may be. We also wonder for a fleeting moment where the world is headed. After that, we promptly withdraw into our respective bubbles because these issues do not personally affect us. That might seem to be the natural thing to do and also the only possible option available. But is that correct? Can we enjoy the blessing of security while remaining totally indifferent to the suffering of millions who are less fortunate? What are the lessons of history about such massive indifference? What about Swami's teachings? Do they have any relevance at all in relation to what is happening around? These are some of the questions we ought to ponder about. Now, there are people who feel that one must speak only about positive things, which automatically rules out any reference to the urgent but at the same time ugly, gruesome and even dangerous problems. I take a different view. Yes, one must undoubtedly be positive and strongly advocate positive values as opposed to negative tendencies. That said, it is equally important to be acutely aware of the things that are wrong and feel actively concerned about how those things may be set right. In taking this view, I believe I am on strong ground, because Swami himself has compared Bhishma with Vibhishna and described how the latter was far better. Though belonging to the Rakshasa clan, Vibhishna spoke out boldly against Adharma when there was a need to. By contrast, not only the venerable and learned Bhishma, but also other gurus like Kripacharya and Dronacharya chose to remain silent when grave atrocities were being committed in public in the royal court of the Kauravas. Swami said that failing to speak out in defense of the Dharma must be considered a crime. One commentator put it neatly and in today's context. He said, when highly vocal fringe groups with outrageous if not extremist views are allowed to wield a huge megaphone, while all of us either acquiesce or just remain silent, then one of two things could happen. Either the fringe group would simply race away to wield total power, or a counter fringe on the opposite side would appear. In one case, there would be unilateral domination by the fringe group, while in the other, there would be extreme polarization with the silent majority caught in the middle in a painful crunch. Clearly, both are bad options. Now, one does not have to look beyond today's papers and television to find many examples of what I just said. And this has gone on throughout history. That is why in India, the Puranas constantly held out examples of a just society and gave it the name Ramrajya. It simply meant a society where truth and righteousness held sway. The Western world has its counterpart in Utopia, but I doubt if Utopian society laid as much stress on Satya and Dharma as Ramrajya did. Today, for the Kali Yuga, we need a version 2.0 of Ramrajya, which is what Swami laid out for us. Premarajya, if I may call it that. To help us understand how important as well as effective Premarajya can be, let me for a moment make a brief reference to a recent event, namely the horrifying and blood-curdling incident in which a young man, presumably mentally deranged, shot his way into a school in the small and picturesque town named Newtown, the state of Connecticut in America. And this man mowed down 20 children and 6 teachers, all within a few minutes, with a fast-firing semi-automatic weapon. He then killed himself. By the way, before coming to the school, he killed his mother. I shall not go into the gory details, but instead comment briefly on why gun violence in America outstrips that in all other countries. There is, of course, a valid historical reason for the so-called famous Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that allows citizens to bear arms. Not many are aware that after defeating the British Army, the former colonies of Britain in what is now called America did not come together on day one to form one country. They continued for a while as independent and sovereign states. While wise elders deliberated intensely about whether they should come together as one country, and if so, in what manner. And finally, they chose to become one country. And one of the things they decided was not to have a standing army. This may sound unbelievable in today's context, but back then there was a serious distrust in armies, since armies could side with a king and help him become a dictator. Then arose a question. Suppose these newly created United States were to be attacked by a foreign enemy. What then? There would be no standing army. What were the people to do? That was when the Constitution framers decided that citizens, especially those who had fought in the recent War of Liberation, ought to have the right to possess their arms so that they could instantly come together to fight the invader. And let us not forget that Britain did try to recapture the lost colonies. In fact, they even managed to burn down the White House, to which President Obama made a humorous reference recently while welcoming Prime Minister David Cameron of United Kingdom. What I am driving at is that a historical constitutional amendment with a definite political objective was in due course surreptitiously used by gun manufacturers to create a very powerful lobby, powerful both in political and in financial terms. So strong has the clout of this lobby become that it has managed to lock the mental attitudes of most people to the era of the Wild West, so to speak. I can say chapter and verse on this subject, but I shall not. Instead, I shall just call attention to an obvious statistics to which Fareed Zakaria of CNN drew pointed in emphatic attention. Fareed's point was simple, and he made it by comparing two countries, namely America with a population of about 300 million people, and Japan with a population of about 120 million people. In America, thanks to the deliberate manipulation of the gun laws, there are about 280 million guns. Stated differently, while in the USA there are roughly about 90 guns for every 100 people, in Japan, because of very strict gun laws, the corresponding figure is 0.6 guns for every 100 people. 90 guns for every 100 people in one country and 0.6 guns for every 100 people in another country. And that difference is what regulation does. Thus, During last year, while there were over 10,000 gun-related homicides in America, in Japan, the number was zero, exactly zero. Many others have commented on this striking difference, and here is what one writer says. I am sorry I did not take care to note down the citations, but that omission is easily taken care of by going to the Google. You will get all the details of the original reference. Now, this is what this writer says. In 2008, the United States had over 12,000 firearm-related homicides. All of Japan experienced only 11. Fewer than were killed at the Aurora Theater in the state of Colorado. And that was a big year of killing in Japan. 2006 saw an astounding number of only 2 killed. And when that number jumped to 22 in 2007, it became a national scandal in Japan. By comparison, also in 2008, 587 Americans were killed by guns that are discharged accidentally. So you see, girls also kill accidentally. That is also a point to be remembered. What it all means is that with sheer discipline, even the impossible becomes possible. Just imagine how much more can be achieved if through discipline and morality, and I stress morality, we are able to gain the grace of God. With so many problems facing humanity, can we say there are no solutions when Swami has laid them out so clearly? The sad fact is we do not either have the time or the inclination to bother about those solutions, since those problems are not directly affecting us as individuals. Incidentally, let me at this point emphatically stress that it is not my intention to paint one country black and the other lily white. In fact, if I turn the gaze on India, we have a zillion things to be ashamed of and even hang ourselves, as the saying goes. My point is entirely different, which is that if we have to face adharma in today's world, and who can deny that is not our job? If you have to face adharma in today's world, then we have no option but to take Bhagwan Baba's teachings very seriously. And so, let me revert to Swami and his teachings by going all the way back to what he said as Krishna to Arjuna about when and why God appears on earth as an avatar. Here's a translation of that famous declaration in Gita. Though birthless and deathless, I, the Lord of all beings, and Prakriti or nature as well, do manifest myself through my own divine potency or Maya. Keeping my nature, Prakriti, that is to say, under control. Whenever the practice of Dharma is on the decline and Adharma is in the rise, I embody myself. I do so for the protection of the virtuous, for the destruction of the wicked, and for the re-establishment of Dharma. And it is for that I incarnate from age to age. This occurs in chapter 4, verses 6, 7, and 8. This declaration is oft quoted and is well known. However, as Swami has stressed several times, avatars come mainly to teach a message. Indeed, Krishna himself says that he comes again and again because the knowledge he imparts disappears with the passage of time. It is when humans ignore the knowledge of the Atma, or Atma Vidya or Atma Jnana as it is sometimes referred to, that the practice of Dharma also steeply declines. In other words, avatars come to remind as well as retrain us to put Dharma back on the pedestal to which it belongs. The avatar does not come as a repairman to fix the problems we have created. As the saying goes, he who breaks the vase must fix it. It is us humans who have in various ways, including sheer indifference, who have allowed adharma to gain ascendancy. It is therefore our collective responsibility to set things right. I am mentioning all this because although the Bhagavad Gita is well known, not many are aware that it is all about doing one's duty. Now, the idea of doing one's duty has existed from ancient times and indeed in all societies, though in varying degrees. Thus, kings had their duties and so did ministers, administrators, soldiers, etc. down the line. And so it is that we find in London the famous statue of Lord Nelson, who declared that England expects every man to do his duty. The beauty about the Bhagavad Gita is that it defines duty in the larger context of not one country, but of divinity. The divinity that is in fact latent in all of us, every single human being. Not merely that. The Gita also wants us to make sure that everything we feel, think, say or do also has the flavor of the divinity that is latent in us. That is the important point, and that is the essence of the Prema Tattva or love principle that our beloved Swami discoursed on so many times over 70 long years. Let me attempt a very quick recap of what Swami taught us. And the simplest way is by going back to the discourse clip that was screened here on Christmas evening. Those of you who are tuned to the live streaming would have seen this clip. Swami's essential point in the discourse was about the way man searches for God. He said, man is going all over the place looking for God without realizing that God is right there within him. Swami then asked, would you go around looking in search of yourself? Would you ask someone you meet on the road and say, sir, have you seen me anywhere? If so, please can you tell me where you saw me? To do so would be utterly ridiculous. But that precisely is what most devotees are doing all the time. That is what Swami said in the discourse, if you had paid proper attention. What Swami was driving at was that all our speech-making, pilgrimages, so-called sadhana camps, service programs, etc. are bereft of meaning unless every feeling, thought, word and deed is intimately linked to the fundamental fact that at the core, all of us, without exception, have the divine spark. I have heard any number of discourses, but hearing this one on Christmas Day after a long time, this particular sentence was to me absolutely electrifying. Please allow me to explain why. Now, throughout, Swami has always hammered in the following truth. One, first realize there is a spark of divinity in you. Two, next appreciate that this same spark, divine spark, is present in every single entity in creation, which automatically means that God is obviously present in all fellow beings. Three, remember, God is love and love is God. And make sure that when you go out into the world, and you cannot escape this, make sure your feelings, thoughts and words and actions are not tainted by any undesirable traits that range from anger all the way to jealousy, ego, selfishness and self-interest. Four, all traits take root in the mind before manifesting as actions and words. Hence, you must be very careful about safeguarding the mind from spiritual infection. Five, the best protection against spiritual infection is the constant chanting of God's name. The choice of the name is left entirely to you. However, as a line in the bhajan, Govinda Bolo, Gopala Bolo, stresses, make sure you always call out the name of your choice with pure love and deep feeling. If you recall, the line is, Prem se bolo, bhav se bolo, jo naam chahe, wo naam bolo. It is pertinent to offer a few remarks on the above, as they are very important. And this I shall do by going back to the 12th chapter of the Gita, where there is a discussion between Arjuna and Krishna regarding the best way to worship God. Krishna says, Arjuna, there are basically two ways to worship God. One is to directly go inwards, and the other is to journey inward via an outer path. In practical terms, the first choice boils down to straightaway worshiping God with form, while choice number two begins with the worship of God with form, and thereafter slowly graduating to the worship of the formless God. Krishna then adds, Arjuna, for you the latter path is preferable. To put it differently, the choice number one is the so-called inward path and is referred to as Jnana Yoga, while choice number two, or the outward to inward path, is nothing but a suitable mix of Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga, the mix being tailored to suit the individual. Keep all this in mind along with what Swami said in the discourse played here on Christmas Day. We can paraphrase the essence of Swami's sayings or teachings as follows. Bangaru, remember, a sprinter who is doing a 100-meter dash is totally focused on the finish line, right from the moment when he gets on the starting block. Likewise, you too must not forget for a moment that your goal is God, and also that God is already in you. Indeed, I have called attention to that in my discourses any number of times. Now it follows that if God is in you, He is obviously in others also. Hence, when dealing with others, be very careful with your thoughts, words and actions. You may not be aware of it, but even thoughts can cause harm, for they are very powerful. Thoughts are extremely powerful because they are born in the mind, which has been bestowed with enormous power by God. Few appreciate the fact that no other living being on earth has been given this incredible blessing and power. That is why birth with the human form is a rare blessing. Now, why has God given humans the mind with all this power, enormous power? He has done this so that you may realize that behind the seen lies the unseen. In other words, though God cannot be directly seen in this world, His power is immanent in every single bit of creation, from the atom to the galaxies, from the ant to the elephant. Sadly, people fail to appreciate this and instead allow their minds complete freedom to think the way it wants, especially in a negative manner. Avoid that. If a sprinter makes a bad start, he is doomed to lose the race. In spirituality, however, even if you have started rather hesitantly, it does not matter, as long as you quickly develop faith in me. What exactly is the meaning of having faith in God? It means that you must earnestly believe that not only am I in you, but also in every single entity in creation. That is the essential point about having total faith. Once you realize that God is indeed omnipresent and never forget that truth, even for a moment, your life would change completely. Often I tell you two things. Firstly, I say, help ever and hurt never. And secondly, I say, love all and serve all. Every time I say this, everyone claps loudly, but fails to look carefully at the fine print. And believe me, there's a lot of fine print. Hurt never means, do not ever cause hurt in any form to anybody at any time, including via thought. Following that instruction would be a very good start. Having started on the right foot, try next to help whenever you can. It does not have to be a great piece of help, but if you offer that help with a radiant face and a good smile, that little help will always go a long way. The cake may be big, but have you noticed that the icing is always a thin layer? And what a difference that thin layer of icing makes. So, always serve the other person with respect and love, constantly telling yourself that Swami is in that person and that your service is actually reaching me. People routinely repeat the phrase, love all, serve all. But it is amazing how quickly those very same people who give this advice soon become bossy, rude and bureaucratic when they are doing seva. Do you know why this happens? The reason is simple. They do not see Swami in the persons, the boss over. Nobody talks to Swami like that. They are always very loving and respectful. But when it comes to seva, including Narayan seva, what happens is the tasks are routinely performed. Narayana or the Lord is seldom seen in those who are served, nor is He served the way He ought to be. This is a clear symptom of Dehabhimanam or body consciousness, which in practical terms manifests as a feudal attitude. Is that what I asked of you? Whatever happened to the humility that was part of the fine print? I know that Swami has never said all that in any single discourse. What I have done is to bring together the teachings of Sai from many places to make a coherent argument in the present context. And I hope you will take it in that spirit. In other words, what I have said above is a comprehensive paraphrase of the many things Swami has said at various times, mostly when talking about duty. Since duty is so vital for leading a useful and spiritual life, allow me please now to take a few more minutes to make some pertinent remarks about duty. In the Gita, Krishna uses the term swadharma while referring to duty. The word itself translates as dharma of the self. Swa means self. Technically, this is an acceptable translation. But problems arise when one tries to understand the term self or swa. Such a difficulty arises because in spirituality there are really two entities associated with the word self. Firstly, there is the lower self, which is nothing but an individual wrapped up in ego due to spiritual ignorance or ajnana. And secondly, there is the higher or realized self, which is the individual who has a body but has shed body consciousness or Dehabhimanam. Body attachment goes away when ajnana or spiritual ignorance is scrubbed away, following which the individual acquires a radiance that emanates from true wisdom or the jnana latent within. The much talked about sadhana is all about spiritual scrubbing or a refinement that elevates one from the lower self to the higher self. For operational convenience, people often use the lowercase I to refer to the ego self and the uppercase I to refer to the higher self or the realized soul. Ramana Maharshi would be a good example of a realized soul. Keeping this in mind, let us return to Krishna's use of the word swadharma. For him, the prefix or swa automatically meant the higher self or the atma. In other words, when Krishna asked Arjuna to perform his duty, the subtext was that Arjuna ought to perform his duty in the spirit of a realized soul or the higher self. Most commentators appear to miss this point, and I have given lengthy commentaries relating to duty of the lower self, which is clearly incorrect. You might at this point jump in to say, listen, 99.9999% of us are not realized souls. What we want are guidelines about how to do our duty, even as we are trapped in the lower self and ego. I agree, it's a good point. And in fact, this is where Krishna's teaching of Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga come in. Swami gave us that very same recipe that would help us rise from the lower self or ego self to the higher self. And his formula was, love all, serve all. Now, in other words, Swami's formula is really a beautiful amalgam of Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga tailored for this day and age. For the sake of completeness, let me also mention that Swami has on various occasions used terms like Atma Dharma and Mama Dharma, which means my duty, in place of what Krishna referred to as Swadharma. Stated differently, these three words, Swadharma, Atma Dharma and Mama Dharma, are interchangeable. Once again, let me stress, Swami does not want us to become recluses or ochre robe wearing wandering monks. He does not, definitely not. He allows us full freedom to serve him in any walk of life, all the way from being the president of a country and a super CEO to a simple firefighter, school teacher, a janitor, and even a loving homemaker. We in the world make all sorts of distinction between these and similar categories of people. From an outward point of view, certain protocols are necessary, and Swami himself has observed these social norms to the extent they did not go against basic moral principles. But when it came to dealing with these people as individuals, I have seen Swami giving the most charming smile to a very poor person as compared to a tycoon who Swami was aware had shown up mainly to beg for favors. For Swami, it was always very simple, and he made this point succinctly in the Gita Vagini. Here's a paraphrase. Life has to be lived on earth. There is no escape from it. And our feelings, thoughts, words and actions are mostly shaped and conditioned by what happens on earth and how they affect us. Our actions are perforce a response to all this, which is to be expected. However, and this is very important, the motivations for the actions should not be based on worldly considerations alone. Rather, they should spring from within and must be rooted firmly in eternal values, namely Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema and Ahimsa. Since these values are nothing but the manifestations of various aspects of the Atma, duty performed in the spirit is nothing but Atma Dharma. In other words, your actions must always reflect the nature of the Atma. That would happen only if you stay constantly tuned to me. Your actions would then carry the fragrance of the blossoms of heaven. If, however, you allow your mind to guide you, your actions would reflect the ego self, and understandably, they would then carry the foul odor of selfishness and self-interest. I think I have said more than enough. I apologize for the fact that this talk has become a bit too long, but then there were so many things to share with you. I thank you all for your patience, that is, if you have been with me this long. Please do share your thoughts and comments with us, for they are always helpful, especially when they are critical. Offering this talk at the lotus feet, I now bring it to a formal close. God bless and Jai Sai Ram.